Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. So glad that we're able to do this tonight once again. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Bill, how are you?
You know, I'm well. It's always nice to see you. We've got a lot to talk about tonight before
getting
we bring
down
our guest.
That intro music. Beach music.
Yeah, it gets us in the mood every week, so we're grateful for that. And George, we're looking forward to talking to Devon tonight. We're going to bring him on, time permitting. Depends on how well we do. But let's get to business here, which is what we do. Do we talk about a step every week?
We do.
Today,
and you know why we
today
do that?
Should be no exception.
Well, this evening, I want to talk about a step. And you know why we do that, Bill? It helps us walk out our faith. And one that I always talk to my guys about, because, Bill, the guys we work with are deciding their eternal destiny and how they're going to live out the rest of their life. And usually what happens, God allows us to go our own way. And a big crisis happens to get our attention, legal, marital, relational, occupational. And when guys work with us to get sober and to find Jesus, they wonder how their life is going to be. Is this going to be good enough for me, Bill? We lose a lot of guys who go, yeah, I know Jesus wants me sober, but George, that life is so boring. I'm not going to have any fun. And we talked to him about Ephesians 4, about putting off the old and putting on the new. But, Bill, we're always really good about talking about that. When we look at our lives, it didn't turn out anything like we thought it would. When you make a decision to follow Jesus, you get out of the decision-making business.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to get out of the way. I was talking with my mentor, Denny, a while ago, and I said, I don't know how to solve this problem. He goes, well, you're not supposed to. You're supposed to be obedient and wait for God to do his work. And I thought, you mean I sit back and be obedient, pray, and do your life, and don't mess up what God's going to do. Just be patient, be still, and know that I am God, Psalm 46:10. And, Bill, I always feel like I have to do something, but as I look back on my life and I look at guys that we work with, God doesn't save you and get you sober without having a job for you to do. And the thing that really makes your recovery better than you're using and sustainable and exciting, Bill, we work with guys. A lot of those guys don't make it and they die. I'm an adrenaline guy, and there's nothing more exciting than the eternal destiny of somebody you're working with. And when they make it, there's nothing better than that. And you know it, I know it, and that's what keeps you doing it. So just relax. Don't worry about the outcome. That let go and let God really means is I'm responsible for the effort. He's responsible for the outcome.
Mm-hmm. George, I love step two that says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Sounds like for many people, and I have a feeling Devon's story tonight is going to include starting drugs and alcohol at a young age. So it's pretty hard to know sanity when you start at a young age being insane using drugs.
Sure. And do you think the world we live in is sane or insane, Bill?
Insane.
Okay.
Yep.
And Jesus said in John 14:6, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through the Son. Truth is an absolute. Something's not kind of true or sort of true. It's all true, and that's Jesus. And if you live in the truth and seek the truth, you're going to find the truth.
Yeah, and I love Philippians 2:13 that says, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. So way back when you're mixed up and you are confused and using drugs and alcohol, even then God has a plan. Not only for restoration and redemption, but a plan moving forward.
I think the hard part for a lot of us when we start a relationship with Jesus and start into recovery, is this really going to be good enough? And I want to go to the 11th chapter of Hebrews, that faith is the assurance of things hoped for and being certain of that which I cannot see. Take by faith that God's way is better. And one thing you know for sure, yours is not working. Your best thinking, your desires got you here. And I know for me, the reality was, Bill, that one day, what I really want to do is killing me. Maybe I shouldn't make my own decisions. And to this day, I don't. I pray, and I've got a bunch of people that I bounce things off of. And things kind of work out. Things that used to baffle me, I intuitively know how to handle.
That is such good news, George. I appreciate you mentioning that tonight and reminding everyone listening that that is the truth. We need to be in community, and we need to listen to others.
So really what it gets down to, do you trust God or don't you? And I need to work on that.
That's great. So we're glad that you have tuned into Real Recovery. If you are new to the program, welcome. I don't know where you've been, but we're glad you're here. And if you have a friend or maybe you yourself have an addiction issue, we're really glad that you have decided to do something about it. And our prayer, George and I, is always going to be the same every week, that you will come to know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior.
Absolutely. And trust and obey. There's no other way. And his ways, I've never met anybody who walked with God, got sober, who thought, you know, this really didn't work out. I wish I was still using.
Yeah, well said. So if you are just learning about us, we're glad. We have lots of episodes that already exist on the podcast at myfaithradio.com, because sometimes you need a meeting and you can't get to one. So I know a lot of people will use Real Recovery as a way of almost feeling like a meeting. It's not the same because it's not accountability and in group, but it is a chance to feel inspired by someone's good story.
So you're saying it's better than nothing. And I agree with you 100%.
Better than nothing.
I always like hearing God's story to a victory.
Yeah. All right. Well, we take a little break. When we come back, Real Recovery is going to have another award-winning story. Devon is going to be on the program after a short break. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be right back. Back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. George, I'm looking forward so much to tonight because I had a chance once again to meet Devon, and what a story, what a testimony. Amazing what God has done in his life and how he's helping others. So I can't wait to get to it. What do you say, George?
Looking forward to that. Let's go.
Yeah, Devon, welcome.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you guys having me.
Yeah, like always, we start at Real Recovery. We want to hear about a young Devon, what life was like growing up, what family life was like. Did you have friends? Did you hang out with the right crowd, the wrong crowd? Did you go to church? All that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. I actually grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. And like a lot of young kids in Baltimore, Maryland, man, it was rough. It was a pretty rough neighborhood in the city where I lived in West Baltimore. My mom actually had me when she was 15 years old. So that just within itself, created a dynamic where, in a sense, she was growing up while raising me at the same time. My dad actually wasn't in my life. He actually wound up going to the military. He was 17 at the time, and he wound up going to the military. Him and my mom didn't stay together. So growing up, it was just myself and her and some family. And, I was able to create some sort of friendships, but my mom was very protective over me. She would keep me in the house a lot and, just to protect me and make sure, nothing happened. But then that all changed when my stepdad came into my life around 10 years old. He came in and my mom got married, and I remember him taking me outside to a group of guys, and they were outside hanging out, and he's like, "Hey, this is my stepson, man. I want you guys to take care of him and make sure that you look out for him in the neighborhood." And he left me there, right? And so that was like a big eye opener for me. I had never really, my mom wouldn't let me basically, go out and be around a lot of things. And from there, he didn't know he had actually basically left me with some of the worst guys in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They were some really bad guys, man. I just began to see so many different things. I kind of lost a lot of my innocence during that time, just seeing the things that they were doing. They were selling drugs. They were getting into fights and things of that nature. Gangs were starting to form in the city around that time. And so, I kind of grew up all of a sudden between 10 and 13, like really fast, man. And by the time I was 13, I was full fledged, you know, just Baltimore street knowledge and smarts and all of those different things. And my stepdad wound up on drugs and he was out of the picture now. So it was back to me and my mom again. And he has to work, so I'm fending for myself. And, you know, I got into a lot of different things. I really respected her so much that I would try to hide a lot of things from her. But she wasn't stupid. She knew some of the things that I would get into, but it was kind of hard for her to reel me in as a single mom, as well as her trying to work and provide and take care. And so I just found myself, you know, doing some of the same things I learned, the drugs and selling the drugs and smoking and drinking and all of these things. And this is by 13, I'm doing all of these things, man. And that just continued on throughout my high school years. So, yep, that's how everything started for me.
Any sports, any church attendance, kind of grades were you getting?
So, yeah, I did try sports. I was good at basketball, but again, doing the things that I was doing, I had no structure. I had no discipline for practice or any of those different things. And so I remember the coaches telling me, hey, man, you're great. We want you to come out. And I actually planned to go one year. I did play one year and I was a mess, man. I wanted them to let me do what I wanted to do. And the next year I was going to go to practice. And I remember just turning around and not going, man. So, football was here and there, same as basketball. I didn't like the structure of things because I was just out of control at the time. But, church was not something that we attended. I had someone in my life who was a real good close friend of my mom, and she became my godmother when I was very, very young. She would take me to church with her when I was young, like too young to kind of really remember, but I just remember her saying that I would say, you know, there would be a time in my life where I would, you know, I would be a preacher and I would do these things. But yeah, my family was not churched. You know, I probably didn't pick up a Bible and read it till I want to say maybe 18, maybe 18 or 19. So that was something that just it wasn't prevalent in my life. I knew that God was present, but I had my times as a teenager where I just denied that. I didn't believe that God was real. I didn't believe, you know, just because of my circumstances and the things that happened around me. And then I didn't have a lot of people actually around me who were, you know, giving me the gospel.
Mm. Devon, talk about your education between the ages of 10 and 13. What were you learning on the streets, and what were the other guys teaching you, talking to you about, convincing you to do, to try, to experiment with? What was all that about?
Sure. At the time, I really had no knowledge of pretty much doing anything wrong outside of just, you know, the regular kid things, lying and, you know, just being a kid. But there was one guy who was like a really, really big drug dealer in the city. And I believe around that time, crack cocaine became something that was really, really big in the city. And I began to learn just seeing him, how they would do it, how they would sell it. They began to carry guns and things of that nature. I had never, you know, held a gun until that point in my life, just being around them. They were literally showing me and teaching me these things, how and what type of weapons and what type of drugs they sell, how much it cost, and how to create it, how to make it. And then even getting into fights and things. I remember, you know, the guy teaching me how to box. He would take me to the boxing gym and he would get into it with like young guys, but they would be too young for him to fight. So he would be like, hey, I'm going to have Devon fight him, you know, for me and stuff like that. It was just, for them, it was like a badge of honor. Like, hey, man, you're growing up. You're part of us. You're one of us. And like I said, me kind of being just green to everything, I looked at it as, okay, this is normal, sadly. I didn't know at all that I was, you know, being led in a direction that was really destructive.
All right, George, I have a question for Devon. And so you're 13, he's 13 years old. Is he having a different lifestyle? Is he showing up with brand new sneakers at home and all the kind of stuff that mom's going, whoa, wait, Devon, where'd you get that?
Right. I'm hiding them.
Okay.
I'm, I'm literally hiding things to the point where I remember having a pair of sneakers that had holes at a hole at the bottom. And she's like, "Why didn't you tell me you had a hole at the bottom of the sneakers?" I'm like, "No, I'm fine." She's like, "No, we got to get you a pair of sneakers." And I'm saying to myself, "No, I'm fine. I'm fine. Now you don't worry about it." And so I'm hiding it from the sense of a respect that I had for my mom, and somewhat fear too of just letting her down, because my mom was always one that would tell me, "Hey, this is not the direction you want to go. This is not what you want to do." And that's why she tried to protect me so much. But being in the city and in that area, it was hard to, protect. So I hid a lot of that stuff. I even had friends who would keep clothes I would leave out, have in my book bag, have a different pair of sneakers, a different outfit. Like, just it took a lot of energy to hide that stuff, for sure.
What was it like for you to have secrets from your mom?
Man, it was, for me, it was the sad part, like you said, the energy that it took. And not just her in general, but I was really, I wasn't bad in school, believe it or not. I had good, I got grades that were good because I was very intelligent, and I would even skip school sometimes, and my friends would fail, and I would go back and make up my work, right? Like, I would go and get the work. And so I would even, from a teacher standpoint, from my friends, moms and parents standpoint, they were like, "Man, he's a good kid." And they're like, "Man, he's the worst of all of us." You know what I mean? So I would, I, it was really hard and difficult, and it was stressful. It was, it got to a point where I'm like, "Man, I don't even want to deal with hiding and doing these different things." But it was just a part of who I was, and I was so far deep into just hiding and doing so many different things that it felt like I couldn't escape it in some ways.
So, were you doing drugs yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I was really heavy, believe it or not. At 13, I want to say 12 to 13 is the first time I smoked marijuana with another guy that I knew. He had a cousin who visited from California, and we were just hanging out, and I saw him smoking, and he handed it to me, and I'm like, I just took it and I smoked it. And then I remember him telling me, cigarettes help boost it. So I started smoking cigarettes, and then drinking a lot with some of the friends I had who were from New York. They were really big and heavy into, drinking beers and stuff. So by 13, 14, man, I was drinking like a 40 ounce of liquor, malt liquor, and then other types of liquors and marijuana and all of those different things.
So if you're drinking a 40, it's got to get a little warm before you finish it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does, but believe it or not, man, we were drinking it fast. It was sad. Like, and looking back on it, it was like a thing. And I was shaped a lot by the music that I listened to. And I remember at the time, like Snoop Dogg and the guy Dr. Dre and all, that was the culture of it, was like marijuana, and liquor. And it was like, you drink a 40 and you drink it down fast, and you smoke, and that was just a part of what it was.
So you were cool.
You say cool?
Yeah, cool guy.
I
Friends
don't.
are cool, you know.
Well, that's what they would consider it then.
No,
And it was funny, right? Because
I get you, but you thought that at the time, right?
oh, without a doubt, I thought I was a part of the crowd that was, and everybody else who was doing it was the same. They thought that that was the cool thing to do. They thought that that was the right thing to do. And honestly, I don't think it was even a thought of whether it was cool or not. It was just something that everyone around you did, and you figured, okay, if I want to be a part of that crowd, if I want to be a part of what's going on, then I'm going to do it as well.
All right, Devon, I'm stuck when you're age 13 and some guy is a drug dealer showing you how to handle a gun. So all of a sudden now you've introduced the idea of having a gun, touching a gun. I don't know if you practice shooting it. Did you end up having one in your possession ever? Because that really raises the stakes.
I remember having it in my possession. Thank God I never had to. Like, I was always, man, I was always in my mind, I was always still like, I'm not like them. You get what I mean?
Oh,
That's
sure.
how I really thought. And so it was a point in time where they would say, "Hey, man, you got to hold this, you got to have this, because you got to make sure you're protected, because I would be out there with those guys." And they would get into different things, and I would hear about what they were getting into, but caught up into a lot of their situations because, man, I still went home. I still, you know, a lot of times, even now, when I talk to kids, I say, man, gangsters don't go to school and gangsters don't, you know, go home and follow rules. And that's why I knew I wasn't a gangster. I was still going home, right? Like, I was making sure that, you know, my mom said, be in the house at 10. I was going in at 10, right? Like, you know, it was certain things and rules that I would follow. And there were certain principles that I had that I wasn't going to go beyond and I wasn't going to do.
That's fascinating that you still had a sense of right and wrong and you had an ultimate respect for your mother, which I love because you were not going to be violating her trust, even though you were, right?
Right. And even in violating her trust because of, you know, my age and being young,
yeah.
I justified it with like, okay, I'm not going to disrespect her by, you know, just doing it with no regards to how she feels or what she thinks about it, but not realizing I was still disrespecting her by doing it anyway.
Of course. All right. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Our guest, Devon, is telling quite a story. We're going to come back after a short break and hear lots more. We'll be right back. We were not gone long, and we are back. Devon is our guest. George, what a story. I love the way that he is loving and respecting his mom, but he's also on the street learning the ways of the street.
Real honest.
Yeah, real honest. So, Devon, let's get back to just post-13. You're learning the ways of the street. You're probably starting to do more and more criminal-type behavior. Did you have any trouble with the law?
I had it later on. I got to a point where I started doing more things where it was getting noticed. And, you know, now the police are finding out what's going on. Now we're running. And I when I go into the prison to speak with young guys or even older guys, I make this joke and some laugh and some don't. But I always tell them, I say, man, you know, I could have been in here with you guys, but I was smarter than you. Right. And they some laugh and some don't laugh. But I thought at the time I was smart because I wasn't getting caught, right? Like, I was getting away, and it got to the point when I finally did get caught. It was for distribution, and it was small, a lot, not a lot, but I remember going in and getting booked and seeing guys that I knew in there, and they were literally yelling, finally, they got him. Like, they were celebrating that I had got caught because it was this thing, like, that I had never, you know, I had never got arrested for the things that I had done, but yeah, the police, man, they were definitely they knew about me, but didn't know exactly who I was, and they knew some of the things that I was doing. But I was really, really careful a lot of times with the things I did and how I moved.
You know, the it's exciting, Bill, and you never get caught. You're kind of invincible. And then that all changes. It's kind of like the guy that likes to fight, and then he loses one. It's not fun anymore.
Yeah. Oh, and losing that first fight is a eye-opener as well as humbling, because that humbled me when I got caught. I remember being in there, and I said to myself, this is not for me. This is not what I want. I remember leaving. And when I got out on my own recon, luckily. And sadly, too, I got off. This was the craziest story thing ever. I got off more so because when they caught me with money, they caught me with cocaine, and they caught me with some marijuana. And I told them that the cocaine was not for selling. I was using it. I was putting it on my marijuana. I was lacing it with it. And so now they're like, well, we got to get you in the treatment program. Right? Like, they're saying, okay, he's not. He's, you know, he's using it. So I'm now heightened, you know, and they're making fun of me. The guys are in there saying, yeah, man, we got a guy in here. He's a cokehead. He's this and that. And for my sake, I'm like, man, whatever will get me out of a distribution charge was my thought. And it didn't go any further than, you know, them actually letting me out on my own recon and me wound up with probation before judgment.
Mm-hmm. All right. So did you spend a little bit of time in jail or prison?
Oh, no, no. Just 2 days in jail.
Okay, that 2 days in jail. All right.
Yeah, that was my...
that was your punishment.
Yeah, that was my...
That's enough to get the general idea, isn't it?
That's plenty.
Right. The general idea was, you know what? I've seen it. I know plenty of friends who had done many years. And right there, I said, you know what? This is not what I want for my life at all, man. I don't want to get arrested and go to jail at all.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you have friends, former friends and guys, you know, who've said, and they can do time. I got guys I work with that can do time. Aren't you glad God made you a guy that couldn't do time?
I'm so glad of that, because I have friends. I have one of my best friends who was doing some of the bad things with me later on in my later teen years, who came to live with me and my mom. He wound up going to prison after I left doing a lot of those things. He went to prison for 5 years. And when I talk to him now, and even during the time, I'm just, sometimes I stare at him and I'm like, man, how... And what ways does your mind work that you're able to, you know, be confined like an animal, man? Like, I can't fathom it or think about it in my mind how he was able to, you know, endure it.
Mm-hmm. So, Devon, I really want to hear, because I remember you when I met you, you were talking about having a pretty intimidating persona. People were reluctant to want to connect to you. They were almost a little afraid of you. And... you had this aura that who's going to get close to you? How about no one? What happened?
Right. So I think around later on, I want to say 16, 17, I'm in high school. I came from the city area in Baltimore, and I moved to the county area. My mom moved out there just to try to, I guess, get away from some of the craziness of the city. But I had this thing where it was like, okay, I'm tough because I came from the city. You guys are county guys. And I kind of took on that persona, but really it was more of a protective, personality that I had to just really protect myself, knowing that I could be, you know, a victim of anything. And, I wasn't really fond of building any type of relationships outside of the people that I knew already. And I gave that off a lot. Even my wife now will tell people, because she went to high school with me, and she's like, he bullied me into this relationship. she'll tell them that, because, you know, even when I first met her, I would make fun of her. She's just like, you were just mean and you were just angry and you were just this person that just was not fun to be around. And I think that people saw it, and there were some who saw beyond it, like my wife. She saw that, you know, I was, at least to her, I was a loving person. But yeah, man, that was just a really protective shield that I put up, man, and to keep people not get too close.
Yeah. So tell us about your encounter with Jesus. What was it like for you to be this kid on the street who is calling his own shots, doing what he wants to do, and now all of a sudden, after some trouble and some danger, you start to have a connection to God? And how did that happen?
Sure. Two different times, things that were pertinent about that was, the first one was, I actually went to the military at 18. Sadly, I went in thinking, you know, I'm running away from all of this stuff, and, you know, this is going to be what's good for me, you know, to get me right. And I remember being in boot camp one day, and the guy comes in and he's like, hey, who wants to go to church services? Well, I'm not going and raising my hand because I want to, you know, get to know God. I'm trying to get out of, you know, work at the time. And I raised my hand, and I remember going to the Protestant service. And then the next day they said, who wants to go to the Catholic service? And I raised my hand for that service too. And look, fun story, it was the same guy for both services. It blew my mind, right? And I'm like, but I remember sitting in there and we're singing this song, Our God is an Awesome God. And you got 60, 70 guys singing. And that was the first time, man, I began to like cry. And I look around and other guys are crying. And that was my first time just feeling a sense of like God and who he was and that love for a moment. Right. And
And I didn't understand what it was then, but fast forward, once I, you know, came back home, because I went reservist at that time. And, you know, my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, we were still friends. One year after some guys, I got into some situations, and a guy I knew had got murdered and killed, and it was really connected to some things that he wanted me to do. And I'm like, just thinking to myself, I need to figure out how to, you know, I had been doing music at the time, and I was rapping. I became pretty much a big rapper in the city, and got this deal from a record label. And I remember calling my wife and told her about it. And she's like, hey, you need to come talk to my pastor about it. And my first thought was, no way, this man is going to ask me to give money to the church. That's all they want, right? Like, that's my first thought. I'm like, no, I don't want to. She's like, trust me, just come and talk with him. And I actually called him. And the question he asked me was, you know, after I told him all of these big accomplishments and what I was doing and pray for me and all of this, he's like, man, but what about your soul? And man, it hit me like bricks. I was like, what do you mean? Like, what does that even mean? And he's like, man, let me talk to you a little bit about like what you've gone through. And I felt like this man had read the book of my life, right? Like, he was just talking to me about, you know, all of these different things in life and how it's affected me and how God, you know, had a purpose and a plan for my life through it all. And man, I just began, I remember again, cry on the phone. And I told him, I said, you know what, I'm going to come visit the church. It was New Year's Eve. I want to say 2001, maybe. And I went to visit. My wife invited me, and I was sick with the flu. I didn't know I had the flu at the time, but I decided not to go out and party. I went to church instead. And I remember, man, just first off laying at the altar because I was sick, but, just praying and hearing the message about this hope and God and the purpose he had for my life and how much he loved me. And I didn't immediately, surrender. It took, I want to say I visited frequently, probably a month before one day I looked at my mother-in-law, who was, you know, at the time she knew I was, you know, of course, dating her daughter. And I'm just like, man, you know what? I think I want to give my life. And, man, she grabbed my hand we walked to the front of the church, and she told the pastor, hey, this young man wants to give his life to God. And immediately, you know, it was like a thunderous applause in the church, because this guy who had walked in at one point with the chain, gold chain and earrings and looking crazy and mean and all of this, all of a sudden wanted to give his life. And yeah, man, I gave my life to Christ that day, and I never looked back.
Cool.
Such a great story, Devon. I love the surrender, and I love that your mother-in-law said, let's do this. what a great story. Yeah. So, obviously when you make a decision and you say, I want to surrender my life to Christ, the next step is what we call the sanctification process and learning God's word growing in his word. How did that start for you?
The first start was, you know, I didn't even want to go back home, because I remember just still being connected to so many different things. I had my own place at the time, and I was honestly afraid to fall back into what I knew and what I was doing. And my wife, she tells the story of her ministry to me, you know, at the time, a large amount of drugs, they would call a brick. And he would call me and say, don't get a brick. That would be her specific ministry to me, like, you know, because all of a sudden now everybody wants to, you know, hey, man, I can give you some free drugs. Hey, man, I come do this, come do that. It was just such a pull. And I began to like stay at the church. I mean, literally sleeping there. I would, you know, come do help and work and all of these different things. The music, I walked away from the big deal that I had. I actually stopped doing music and kind of just devoted myself to being at church, to prayer, to getting with mentors. My pastor took me as a mentor and discipling me, walking with him and being around him and being in the word and being connected with other pastors and other men of God. And I did this for 8 years, man. I mean, I got so far away from what I knew that I remember I wasn't really watching TV much. I didn't know what was going on with sports. I wasn't, you know, I knew for me it was going to be something. It took extreme. Like, it was like me literally coming off of a drug. I had to be so extreme in my faith, so extreme in my walk, that some people would say, oh man, it doesn't take, you know, you can still do this, you can still do that. And for me, it was like, no, I need to get as far away from the life that I had. And I did that for 8 years.
How were you surviving with food and stuff?
So I was working originally, which is crazy. I hadn't really worked anywhere outside of the military at the time, but I still was able to start working. But the church was helping me, man. Like, I remember even getting a car because they would see me at the church all the time and helping and doing all these different things. And me and my wife at the time, we decided to get engaged. And she was like, okay, what is your plan? What are you going to do if we're going to get married? Even my church realized this. And I remember one of the ministers actually gave me a car because he's like, man, you're here all the time. I see you need a way to get back and forth. They kind of, in a way, took me on as payroll. And they're like, you're here and you're working and you're doing all these different things. So we're going to make sure you're taken care of. And man, that's what happened. I want to say for the first maybe 4 years or so. And then I started to work like jobs here and there. And eventually I was able to get an actual landscaping company because my stepfather had one when I was young. And I learned that from him. Like, he knew how to, you know, do that and cut grass. I didn't want to do that. But once I found myself like, okay, I'm ready to commit, I knew that was something I could do. And I started an actual landscaping company. And that is how I survived.
That's a good job. Guys love it who do that. Outdoors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so
yeah,
what you
do? Lots of money. Lots of money is what people probably won't say they love to, because it was just, it was so easy to, you know, to, I mean, everyone's grass grows, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Easiest job's having a radio show. But anyway, yeah. you move on. So, so how long did you do that and what did you do afterwards?
So, yeah, I did that. For about 3 to 4 years, and I got kind of overwhelming. I got to a point where it was growing really fast, and I had young guys at the church who were working with me, working for me, and I wound up selling it. Then after that, I started another business with cleaning, and cleaning barbershops and salons and all of those different things, and then that kind of fell apart because I wasn't really interested in that at all, into doing that. So 2010. I kind of went back to the music. I didn't think it was actually a way to do it. To be honest, I was like, man, it's no way I can rap about God. That's corny. That's what I thought. I'm like, I can't do music, you know, talking about God. But 2010, I was, you know, God impressed upon my heart to kind of reach young people with the music. And my first project that I was able to record, I went back to the guys who were, you know, helping me before that I, you know, had left, and told them what I was doing and how God had moved in my life. And they said, man, we'll help you. And they helped me record my first project. And that first project, I said, you know, I'm going to put it out for the young people and see how they respond. But it kind of went national. And I remember getting like a first ballot Dove Award ballot for it. And I'm like, okay, maybe this is something I should be doing. And I began to travel, man. I began to get calls from out of the state to come and do different things, and within the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area. And I said, you know what? I'm going to start my own record label. And I started His Story Music Group in 2010. And that was, from there, I was full-time ministry and music.
Cool. Very cool.
Wow. So you've not only had an entrepreneurial spirit, but you have started several companies, and you've seized all kinds of opportunities that God has led you into. And you would probably say, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but had not been for the grace of God, you wouldn't have had any of those opportunities.
Not a question. But at the same time, I look back at my past and I say, I was learning entrepreneurial just the wrong way, right? I like to tell these guys a lot of times, some of you drug dealers are really businessmen. You don't even know it. You don't know that you're a businessman. Some of you guys are cooking drugs, and you're chemically creating things and don't know, man, you're a chemist. Like, you're missing the calling for your life. You don't realize that you're being led in a different direction. So some of those principles and the things of working that I learned that was bad, I kind of transferred, and I'm like, okay, if I can work for myself and I can do the wrong things, I can get up and not sleep and be tired and do all of these things and do it in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Devon, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we both want to hear about your connection now to young kids and how you reach the younger generation with the Word of God. So we'll take a short break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Ryan's on the board as usual. We'll be right back. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Devon is our guest tonight. What a story, George.
Great story.
Yeah. So, Devon, I'm curious now how God is equipping you and using you to reach kids just like you when you were in trouble and at such a vulnerable age.
Sure. Yeah, he's I didn't know that this was what I was going to do. My wife just had such a passion for young people and kids in general. And I wound up being the student or youth pastor in Baltimore when I was, you know, at that church, and kind of just fell into that position, just being who I was. And we began to bring young kids, you know, from all over the city to our home. And they would just, you know, we would minister to them and get them away from the different things. And so when we moved to Florida, actually while we were there, we were doing foster care as well. My wife was like, hey, we're doing this. We had a young man who didn't have a place to stay. He was like 17, getting ready to turn 18. And he told us, he said, we need more structure like what you guys are doing. And we need you guys in the system. And we didn't understand, but we decided to become foster parents. And we wound up taking in kids. Our first group was a sibling group of girls who were teenagers. And that was, whew, that was tough, right? And actually, second group of kid was my son now, who was adopted, Dylan. We had him since 6 months. He's 12 years old now, and he had a lot of different physical challenges and things of that nature. And we kind of continued that on, and we had multiple kids come through our home. And we wound up, the reason I actually wound up in Bradenton was because when we came to Florida, we started a nonprofit where we were helping families with all of these different Pampers and things that they needed. And Walmart distribution actually partnered with us. And a lady there told my wife about a program where you can take in sibling groups. I just happened to be on tour doing on a music tour, and I'm on the tour bus, and I meet this guy in Colorado who has probably 12 to 13 kids in his home. And I'm asking him like, man, this is amazing what you do here. And he's like, yeah, you know, we adopt, we, you know, do fostering. And I remember praying to God, man, if I had the, you know, resources, Lord, I would do something like this. Well, you got to be careful what you say, because my wife called me maybe 2 days later and she says, we have this opportunity. And I couldn't turn it down because I just asked God for it, basically. And she said, we can move into a foster home in Bradenton. We were living in Kissimmee at the time. And I said, yes. And long story short, we moved in. We took in a group, a sibling group of four. So now we had a house of 10. And man, we were able to care for those kids and get them back home. And that brought me to the church I'm at, because we did our foster care training there. I met the pastor and we joined. And again, God has a plan all the way around. Here I am from Baltimore all the way to Bradenton, Florida. I took on the student pastor position there. I connected with Youth for Christ there, and then consistently began to just work within there. I became a board member at Youth for Christ. Actually, will be at Youth for Christ today. I'll be leaving to go there and hang out with the young kids and the young girls and guys there. It's just been a consistent theme throughout my life that God has always placed me back in the lives of those who have gone through what I've gone through. Some who may not have gone through what I've gone through, but he's given me so many different situations and circumstances where it's not too much that I can't speak into. And I can understand their anger, their frustration, their hurt, their pain, and how they, you know, can navigate throughout this life. And whether that's with Christ or without Christ, I can kind of introduce that to them.
So, Devon, when you talk about sponsoring kids, and you've had about 12 altogether, does that sound correct?
Yes, just through fostering, we've had, coming in and out of our house, at least 12 kids.
Wow, that's impressive. Now, is your wife the same young woman you met like in high school?
Not after all. I mean, we have four kids of our own.
Okay.
Well, we have three that are biological, of course. She is not the same. And when I joke with people about this, I'm like, you know, when you were getting married, we've been married almost 21 years now, coming up January the 1st. And when you first get married and, you know, we first get together in high school and all these different things, and we laugh and joke about it, I look over and I'm like, I can't believe we are married. This is crazy. She's a nurse practitioner now. She's actually a vice president of a home care agency, and they're working with young people. She used to work in the NICU. So just watching her, I can give her a lot of the credit for things that I probably would never have done. I may not have, you know, said, hey, I want to take in 12 kids and, you know, you know,
I'm not guessing you would want to.
But it was a calling, man. Like, really, once I did it, it was like I chose to do it instead of her. I did a lot of it. She said, well, you're doing most of the work. And I didn't realize, you know, it was something that would fulfill, you know, be fulfilling for me. So, but she has been the true definition of a helpmate and help, you know, push me into, you know, really what God had already called me to.
Yeah. Devon, talk about what it's like to make your agenda God's agenda, not your own. Because your course of what's happened in your life is thrilling. It's just every time you tell another layer of the story, it gets more interesting.
Yeah, I can say I haven't had an agenda personally, and I don't know since I gave my life to Christ. I really sometimes feel like I'm walking on a cloud, and if I screw up, man, it's gonna all fall apart. I really do feel that way. So I've always tried to make it a point in my life where there are times and things that come along and I'm uncomfortable. I even may say, you know what, I don't know if I want to do this. And then I have to pray. I have to go back and say, okay, it's not about what I want. It's what I need to do. Is it something that God has, you know, is there a purpose that God has for it in my life? And from experience, what I've always seen is when I follow that route, when I follow that specific blueprint, God always supplied. He always shows up, and he always shows me, yes, this is the direction you should be going. This is what you should be doing. And I'm in it, and I'm a part of it. So for me personally, I just, you know, sometimes I have to actually back away and say, okay, let me consider what it is I should be doing for me. But my agenda is always God's agenda, because I don't know any other way. I really don't. I know what it's like to not have them. I know how I felt. I know that darkness. I know that pain. I know just like feeling hopeless. And I know what it's like to have them. And man, I wouldn't trade it for the world. Not at all.
I think a lot of that, Bill, we hear a lot of stories, and it's suiting up and showing up. I remember Dr. Tim Keller was asked when he moved to Manhattan if it was God's will for him to start a church there. And he said, I don't know. We're going to find out. And you got to get
right.
You got to get into the game, and you have to be walking with God, and you kind of get out of the decision-making business. Bill, I'm listening to this story.
Yeah.
There's no way it winds up like it does.
There's no way.
But you look at all the training he had. You know, he's a businessman. He's like 10 or 13.
Yeah.
And he grows up, and God gives him a love for kids like he was. And he wants to, and nobody's better prepared to do that than somebody that has walked through it and God has, you know, carried him out.
Yeah. Devon, it's a fascinating story. We've loved having you on the show. Thank you for taking the time to share your story. It's been wonderful letting our audience meet you and hear your story.
Yeah, thank you guys for hearing me. You guys kind of put me in a position where I start thinking about things. My wife always say, you need to write a book. You need to, because there's so many stories I could tell you guys, and you would be like, that is impossible. That never happened. But I have witnesses, right?
So it's like, I love it.
It's so many stories I can tell. She's like, you should tell them. So, man, anytime I get a chance to, or anyone gives me a platform to do that, man, I'm grateful for sure. So
that's,
thank you, guys.
That's awesome. Well, George, that's our time. Thank you so much for tuning into Faith Radio tonight and hearing Real Recovery. If you want to pass this along, please go to our podcast at myfaithradio.com. Check it out. Have a great week. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.